whatever new nuclear leak or disaster has happened is perfectly safe for human exposure because it's only X amount over or under background radiation. But then, from a genuine expert, you hear...
When you get into nuclear waste, there's so many hundreds of different materials which are human-made, which never existed on Earth prior to 1939. We have created these radioactive elements. And when they talk about background radiation, they don't tell you that most of these things have a background level of zero if you go back to nature. So when they talk about comparing it with natural background, there is no natural background for cesium-137. It's zero. There is no natural background for strontium-90 or for plutonium. It's zero. The only background is the background that we've created for these things.
Well, that's certainly a wake-up call. And when you hear a baseline verifiable truth like that from Canada's premier expert on all things nuclear in that country and beyond, you may be forced to come out of denial long enough to admit that you are in that uncomfortable seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we continue a series of updates on nuclear issues, this time in an interview with Dr. Gordon Edwards, co-founder and president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Gordon gives us not only specifics on the nuke issues Canada is facing, but really clear information on radiation and how we get intentionally confused by the nuclear industry, the lie of background radiation. And he busts Montreal-based company SNC-Lavalin, which is both ensnared in a political scandal involving Canadian Premier Justin Trudeau and the judicial system, and SNC-Lavalin is also the partner of Holtec International in the rush to cheaply dismantle the decommissioned nuclear reactors in the United States, such as, most specifically, Pilgrim in Massachusetts. This is a cornerstone interview. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than has yet been discussed by any of the Democratic presidential candidates. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 27, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting here in the U.S., where news that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has approved the transfer of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station's license from Entergy Corporation to Holtec International late Thursday has been greeted with outrage from Attorney General Maura Healey, the region's federal and state legislators, and local citizens groups who all say their concerns have been ignored. In a written statement, a spokeswoman for Attorney General Healey called the commission's decision misguided and read, "We continue to have serious concerns about Holtec's financial capacity, technical qualifications, and judgment to safely and properly clean up the site and store and manage Pilgrim's spent nuclear fuel. Holtec has promised accelerated decommissioning, saying it can dismantle the reactor and other buildings, move the spent radioactive fuel into massive dry casks, and clean up the site in about 8 years, at which point they make out like bandits with what's left over from the decommissioning fund. That's right, fast and cheap, just what you do not want with a nuclear reactor decommissioning." And we had two interviews on this on last week's show, number 426. More NRC tone deafness in Southern California. where the agency held a town hall meeting on August 20th in San Juan Capistrano and found that there was a lot for them to swallow. More than 30 speakers criticized the NRC's decision to allow the operator of San Onofre, Southern California Edison, to resume moving 50-ton canisters containing spent fuel assemblies and as much radiation each as was released at Chernobyl from wet storage pools to a newly constructed dry storage facility on the plant's premises, which puts the fuel in canisters that are only 5/8 of an inch thick stainless steel. What's wrong with this picture? Can't you see? Obviously, they can't. Many attendees placed lemons on the table of NRC officials Linda Howell and Scott Morris because critics of the dry storage facility have called the design a lemon. And there's no making lemonade out of this one. In eastern Montana, two men driving a commercial truck hauling radioactive materials died on Saturday, August 17, after colliding with a train. The truck was believed to be transporting radioactive filters, often used in oil fields, to a nearby dump site. But the filters were dumped out along the tracks after the collision occurred. And to think that Holtec wants to build a so-called interim storage site for nuclear high-level waste in New Mexico and then to truck this waste around the country to get to this site. You think an accident like this is the only one that could ever happen? In Arizona in 2017, a 69-year-old man with pancreatic cancer died and his remains were cremated. What nobody at the hospital or the crematorium knew was that just one day earlier, he had been injected with a radioactive compound to treat his tumor. And when his mortal remains were incinerated, this radioactive and potentially dangerous dose of lutetium was still inside his body. Cremating an exposed patient volatilizes the radiopharmaceutical, which can then be inhaled by workers or released into the adjacent community. When researchers analyzed the crematorium operator's urine to see if the employee had also been contaminated by radiation exposure, they found not lutetium, but a different radioactive isotope, technetium, yet another way to be exposed to radiation. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
According to U.S. news website Axios, President Donald Trump has suggested nuking hurricanes to stop them from hitting America. After the report surfaced, in typical gaslighting mansplaining style, he then said he didn't say what several people quoted him as saying. Note that National Geographic published an article pointing out how frequently the idea of nuking hurricanes has been raised over the past several decades. In the article called Nuking Hurricane, The Surprising History of a Really Bad Idea, the magazine pointed out that the response from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration was, needless to say, this is not a good idea. No, obviously we do have to say it. And that's why, Donald Trump, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
In Russia, fallout from the mysterious blast that took place on August 8th suggests that a nuclear reactor blew up. Isotopes identified were strontium, lanthanum, and two forms of barium. According to outside experts, all four particles form from radioactive gases released during nuclear fission and might be expected to drift far from the site of their release. This announcement did offer hints that other, still undisclosed, heavier elements could have been released closer to the blast site. Further news on that blast. The operator of a global network of radioactive particle sensors said on Monday, August 19, that its two Russian sites closest to the mysterious explosion went offline days after the blast, soon followed by two more, fueling suspicions that Russia tampered with them. Yeah, think? The Russian Defense Ministry did not immediately reply to a request for comment. This is what happened on the west coast of the United States after Fukushima. All of our RadNet monitors suddenly were turned off, because if you don't have data, you can't prove anything. According to UK's newspaper The Mirror, 15 people in total are known to have been injured in that explosion. Russian medics who treated radiation victims after that explosion in the Arctic had no protection and now fear that they were irradiated themselves. Russia admitted that radiation spiked to 16 times background radiation, but according to official data, the radiation that reached nearby Severodvinsk was, quote, not heavy enough to cause radiation sickness. That doesn't mean it will not make you sick eventually. And the Russian doctors who treated the patients not only were not warned that they were nuclear accident victims, but Moscow secret police, the former KGB, now FSB, made the doctors sign non-disclosure agreements, damning any flow of information before it could possibly be shared. The five Russian nuclear engineers killed by the explosion were buried in lead-lined coffins. Japan and South Korea are in a radioactive food fight. On August 21st, South Korea said it will double the radiation testing of some Japanese food exports due to potential contamination from the tsunami-damaged, earthquake-damaged Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster site. And regarding the Olympics, South Korea is concerned over food safety at that event and is considering making its own arrangements to feed its athletes at next year's Tokyo Olympics, again citing concern over the safety of food from Fukushima. Food safety concerns in South Korea have grown since Fukushima City was chosen to host 6 softball games, that's women events, and 1 baseball game next summer. Fukushima Prefecture will also be the location for the start and first 3 days of the domestic leg of the Olympic torch relay. The Korea Sport and Olympic Committee is said to have requested international organizations such as Greenpeace be allowed to monitor radiation levels at the Olympic venues. A series of loud, gunshot-like noises were heard at the Heysham nuclear power station in the UK on Friday, August 16. Operator EDF said that it was just part of an operating process carried out at the power station, which is pre-planned. No further announcements and no explanation of what exactly went on. From Reuters, word that 18 nuclear power plants in the EU are operating without a valid license. And in South Africa, plans have been scrapped to buy a nuclear power plant from Russia that would have been ruinously expensive. So now the government is looking for cheaper nukes to buy. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, you know, it's never easy. Nuclear stories and areas of crisis keep multiplying almost as rapidly as our tens of thousands of pounds of radioactive waste. It doesn't matter where you live. Between atomic radiation from atmospheric bomb tests circling the world in the jet stream, to the dangers posed by that nuclear reactor down the road, abandoned uranium mines, or even medical isotopes in the dead, we are all truly in the nuclear hot seat. And the best defense against it is to know exactly what's going on and how to resist its spread. Now in its 9th year, Nuclear Hot Seat remains one of the only places where you can get a 1-hour hit of honest nuclear information every week. Interviews with activists, genuine experts, a roundup of international news, never enough time for all the stories that deserve it, as well as our special Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, bad puns, sometimes a touch of musical theater. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry's drumbeat of propaganda lies? Of course, this show has been operating for years on a monthly budget that is less than what one nuclear lobbyist pays for one dinner with a powerful legislator. And that minuscule budget is dependent on you, the listeners. So this is my invitation to you to help keep us going. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send a one-time donation or set up a monthly donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5, same as a cup of coffee and a good tip here in the U.S., just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please do what you can now, and know that whatever you do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. Nuclear Hot Seat is developing a series of update episodes to bring us up to speed on some of the ongoing nuclear issues that we haven't visited for a while. Last week, we caught up with problems in Piketon, Ohio, from the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant and the spread of radioactive materials into the local community. The outrageous Ohio bailout of two failing nuclear reactors, much to the detriment of solar, wind, and Ohio taxpayers, and Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, where, as you heard, the NRC, which some say stands for Nobody Really Cares instead of Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is rolling over for its nuclear industry masters and transferring Pilgrim's license to Holtec for, quote-unquote, cheap and fast decommissioning. When cheap and fast are two things you do not want in connection with the decommissioning of a highly radioactive, defunct nuclear reactor. That was last week. This week, we catch up with Canadian issues with Dr. Gordon Edwards. He is co-founder and president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, or CCNR. Dr. Edwards has an esteemed background in mathematics, physics, and English literature, which explains why he not only understands nuclear issues, but he can communicate their complexities with clarity. Here, he starts with an overview of the structure of Canadian governmental nuclear responsibility, and then moves on to specific problems throughout the country. Of special interest to U.S. listeners, he also clarifies exactly what the company SNC-Lavalin is and how the U.S. and the NRC are being snookered, or something else, into accepting a corrupt, scandal-riven company as one of the two that is scheduled to dismantle Pilgrim and other defunct nukes. I spoke with Dr. Gordon Edwards on Friday, August 23rd, 2019. Dr. Gordon Edwards, it's great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure, Libby.
Bring us up to date. What is the federal government of Canada doing on its various nuclear issues?
Well, the federal government of Canada has kind of turned the corner, realizing that they're not going to sell any more large reactors because the age of large reactors is finished. It's over. But the age of nuclear waste is just beginning. And the Auditor General of Canada, which is our general accounting office, you might say, they have reported that the federal liability, this is just from the federal government alone, comparable to your U.S. Department of Energy, not a state responsibility, not a provincial responsibility, but the federal government. We have a nuclear waste legacy that amounts to at least $8 billion, according to the General Accounting Office. The question is, what do you do about this? The government of Canada, the previous government, called in corporations. They said, okay, we want to offload this, to privatize it, and to put corporations in charge of doing the job that we, and frankly, don't know how to do. So they hired a consortium of corporations, multinationals, headed by a Quebec company called SNC-Lavalin, and some other companies like Fluor and Jacobs and Rolls-Royce Canada, which is an offshoot of the British company, to run Canada's federal nuclear waste legacy and to take over the operation of all of our federal sites, of which there's about five or six. There's about a million cubic meters of mixed radioactive waste, ranging from very dangerous, highly radioactive liquid. We got 21 tanks of liquid waste left over from reprocessing, which is plutonium extraction in the early days. And also we have solid irradiated fuel bundles, some of which are broken, and some of which have been put into what are called tile holes just near the surface. And we have a whole vast variety of radioactive materials left over from plutonium fuel fabrication, from medical isotope preparation, etc. So everything you can think of, from low, medium, high level, and liquid, solid, gaseous, we've got the whole business. We also have hundreds of contaminated buildings that are contaminated with radioactive materials, including plutonium, that have to be dismantled. And so we got about 2 million cubic meters of radioactive waste, which is other than irradiated nuclear fuel. It's not the irradiated nuclear fuel. It's all the rest of the junk. And there's hundreds of radioactive materials that never existed on Earth before 1939 that are created in the process of nuclear fission. So as soon as you turn on a nuclear reactor, you are mass producing new materials which never existed in nature before 75 years ago. And that's what we call the radioactive waste. And if it's all concentrated in the irradiated fuel, then we call it high-level radioactive waste. But the very same stuff ends up in all the piping and all the pumps and all the seals and all the filters and the clothing. And then we don't call it high-level waste, even though it's the same stuff. It's at a lower level, and so we call it intermediate-level waste or low-level waste. And in the United States, you have three classes of low-level waste, class A, B, and C. The higher class is getting more dangerous. And then you have beyond class C, which is more dangerous still. What people should understand, though, is that talking about a radioactive waste dump is like saying, I'm thinking of a chemical waste dump. Well, if you heard that there was a chemical waste dump, the very first thing you'd ask is, what sort of chemicals do you have there? It makes a big difference if it's asbestos or if it's lead or if it's mercury or if it's pesticides. What kind of chemicals? Chemicals come in all different varieties. Same thing goes with radioactive waste. It doesn't make any sense to think of a radioactive waste repository or dump as being just for one thing. It's for hundreds of things. And that's what we're trying to deal with. So these corporations were hired by the government of Canada to take over the radioactive waste legacy, the federal radioactive waste legacy, and to reduce the liability, quote unquote, as quickly and cheaply as possible. Now, if you've got all kinds of radioactive waste and you want to get rid of it quickly and cheaply, the fact is we do not know how to get rid of it at all. We don't know how to get rid of any of this stuff. Because the fundamental fact about radioactivity is it cannot be shut off. It's a form of nuclear energy that cannot be shut off. That's why nuclear reactors melt down even after they're shut off. It's not because the reactor is out of control. It's because the radioactivity continues to proceed and generate heat that will melt the core of the reactor. And it's that radioactivity, which you cannot shut off, that constitutes radioactive waste. So what do you do with this stuff? All you can do is move it around. You can move it from point A to point B, and then you've got the radioactive waste in a different location. Or you can put it in a container, and then you've got the radioactive waste in a container. But how long does that container last? And when you take the radioactive waste out of the container, guess what? The container has now become radioactive waste. My friend Robert Deltretici calls it the reverse Midas touch. It means that King Midas, the legend goes, whenever he touched anything, it turned to gold. And so he ended up starving to death because he couldn't eat any food. Well, in this case, the nuclear industry, everything radioactive waste touches turns to radioactive waste. We had, for example, a plant in New Brunswick, which was recently refurbished or rebuilt from the inside out. And they had planned ahead of time. They calculated the volume of radioactive waste that would be produced by this. And they built two long buildings to hold the radioactive waste. They ended up with five times the amount of radioactive waste that they expected. Why? Because they weren't careful about segregating the non-radioactive stuff from the radioactive stuff. If you mix together the radioactive and the non-radioactive, then it all becomes radioactive. And so the volume keeps growing in this way. Now, going back to the Canadian situation, when these corporations took over, they decided that in order to handle this waste quickly and cheaply, they just wanted to put it out of the way so that they could go on and do other things. And they decided to create a surface mound 5 to 7 stories high, covering a large area of land, 11 hectares, if you know what a hectare is. That's about 70 professional hockey rinks, right beside the Ottawa River, less than a kilometer from the Ottawa River. The Ottawa River is a major river that flows right through the nation's capital, about 250 kilometers downstream. And then it goes further downstream to Montreal, where I live, and enters the St. Lawrence River when it goes all the way down to Quebec City and out into the Atlantic Ocean. So putting a mound of radioactive waste, which is going to remain dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years, that close on the surface to a river, it just defies common sense. And as a result of that, we've had about 150 municipalities have passed council resolutions in complete opposition to this plan. And we've also had a lot of environmental groups and other people speaking out. Even retired nuclear scientists who are pro-nuclear have spoken out denouncing this particular plan, which is also not advised at all by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which specifically says that you should not put any radioactive waste other than very, very low-level waste on the surface, that it should all go underground. And as a matter of fact, I was just on a webinar the other day with the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission dealing with low-level radioactive waste, and they said that it should be at least 5 meters below the ground, but could be up to 30 meters below the ground, in order to prevent scenarios in the future where people might inadvertently excavate for example, a home site, or drill down into the waste dump without knowing that it is a waste dump. So you have to think about the future. And here in Canada, unfortunately, these corporations have been given a pretty free hand to do what they want. And why? Well, the reason why is because the federal government here in Canada has no policy about how the long-term management of radioactive waste should be handled. So there's no policy, there's no principles. Now, the First Nations got together, the First Nations of Ontario, the Anishinaabeg Nation and the Iroquois Caucus, representing about 90 different First Nations communities, they got together and they hammered out five principles that seemed to them to be common sense. One of them was, you don't put radioactive waste beside major bodies of water, period. Secondly, you don't abandon the waste. Because this waste is planned to be abandoned. This is supposed to be a permanent mound. That means that long after the companies are gone, the mound will still be there thousands of years into the future. And of course, it'll be washed down by the normal erosion and by winds and floods and what have you. So basically, it's just a scheme for not dumping it into the river directly, but letting nature do the job. So it's really quite upsetting, quite contrary to common sense. Now, they also plan to get rid of nuclear reactors owned by the federal government. There's five nuclear reactors owned by the federal government. One of them is on the Ottawa River. One of them is on the Winnipeg River in Manitoba. One of them is right beside Lake Huron. And one of them is on the St. Lawrence River. These are federally owned reactors before the provincial governments got into nuclear electricity generation. And they were basically research reactors or prototypes. But they're pretty big. They range from 20 megawatts in size to 250 megawatts in size. That is of electricity generation. Normally, what we have been told in Canada in the past is that when they come to decommission these reactors, when they come to finally get rid of them, they would take the reactors apart. They would dismantle the reactors, package the radioactive waste materials in very robust packages, and move them off-site to some kind of repository which was more suitable for long-term storage of radioactive waste. What the corporation that's, we call it the consortium of corporations that was hired by the government of Canada has said, oh, we're going to do something much easier and quicker than that. We're just going to put all the waste down into the sub-basement of these reactors and then flood the entire thing with grout. Just grout it in place so that it becomes a permanent concrete outhouse, a concrete mausoleum, a radioactive outhouse forever. Well, radioactive poisons, which again, they have a list of some of the things that are created in the actual structural materials of the reactor. This is something people don't understand, is that inside a nuclear reactor, it's not only the irradiated nuclear fuel, which is really radioactive and which has hundreds of things in it, and that stuff does spread all through the primary cooling system, contaminating the equipment and the pipes, and that's called contamination. But there's something else that goes on inside the core of the reactor. It's called activation. Activation is different. It means the neutrons that are flying around, they hit non-radioactive atoms in the structural materials like the steel and the concrete and the zirconium and whatever else is there. And it makes non-radioactive atoms radioactive so that you get new radioactive materials created right inside the structural materials. This is why, for example, the stainless steel in a nuclear reactor can never be recycled for domestic purposes, because the radioactivity is inseparable from the steel. It's built right into it now. It's inbred, you might say. And so that stuff has to be disposed of as radioactive waste. And what they plan to do, what they used to talk about, is taking this stuff off-site and returning the site to a clean, decontaminated greenfield status. Now, they're just saying, why don't we just leave it there and just dump concrete on it and turn it into a concrete mausoleum, a waste dump that'll last forever. Now, we have a list of those materials, the ones that are created by activation. Many of them have half-lives ranging in the tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years or even millions of years. So we're talking about things that will, remember, the pyramids of Egypt are only 5,000 years old. This concrete mausoleum is going to outlast the pyramids. Tell me another one, you know. So we're very upset in Canada right now, the civilian population. We're very upset about the fact that this consortium is being given a free hand because there's a policy vacuum from the federal government. We're not getting any policy guidance from the federal government of Canada. Why? Well, because I think they're being misled and dazzled by the prospect of making a lot of money, not by the nuclear waste, but by a new generation of nuclear reactors called small modular reactors. The very same companies that are doing these shoddy things with nuclear waste, they want to build small modular reactors, not only all over Canada, but all over the world. It's a new generation of reactors conceived of as being smaller and modular, meaning to some degree mass-produced, in the hopes that by combining the smallness and size with the fact that you can mass-produce components and ship them to where the location is going to be, that ultimately this could be a very profitable business. However, when you actually look at the numbers, you find out that it's very unlikely that it will be profitable. Nevertheless, the government of Canada has bought into this, and already we have an application right now in front of us that's going to be decided upon in the very near future for the very first modular reactor to be built at Chalk River where all the radioactive wastes are. The very same place where they're building this giant heap of radioactive waste, that's where they want to build the small modular reactors. And they want to have 6 or 7 prototypes of different types built there in order to, basically it's using Canadian territory and Canadian funds, because the Canadian government is prepared to put money into this, to finance, to bankroll the international failing nuclear industry in trying to save their skins by developing a whole new generation of small modular reactors. So that's going on too here in Canada. So we have, you might say, what we have here is a corporate takeover of Canada's nuclear policy, because the corporations are running the show. And by the way, these corporations have very shady backgrounds. SNC-Lavalin has been so guilty of egregious bribery and corruption worldwide that they have been banned for 10 years by the World Bank from even bidding on international contracts for 10 years. That started in 2013 and extends until 2023. So they cannot even bid on international contracts. SNC-Lavalin is a gigantic company. They have over 50 subsidiaries worldwide, and none of those subsidiaries are allowed to bid either on international contracts. And that's because of corruption involving the Colonel Gaddafi's family. They even falsified Canadian passports to try and provide a refuge for Colonel Gaddafi's son to escape from Libya. But there was also other corruption in Indonesia and in India and in various other places. So it wasn't just a single case, and it wasn't just a simple matter of a little bribe here, a little bribe there. It was a, you might say, a culture of corruption. And that culture of corruption has been experienced here in Quebec as well. For example, even though SNC-Lavalin is thought of by many Quebecers as a Quebec company, they have been charged with multi-million dollar bribes in connection with building the Montreal Super Hospital, and also with building one of the bridges here in town. They also were found to be guilty of making illegal political donations. It's against the law in Canada for corporations to directly give donations to political parties. So what they had is they had their employees give donations, and then they reimbursed their employees through the company's payroll, and they had a separate system of accounting whereby there was a secret code that was visible on the books that indicated what the repayments were for political corruption. So right now, the SNC-Lavalin is facing criminal charges here in Canada, various types of corruption, including the overseas corruption. Actually, the charges currently pending for the overseas corruption in Libya. And the government of Canada has been caught trying to influence the justice system. The Trudeau government was caught, actually, there was no way that SNC-Lavalin could get out of these criminal charges in Canada except by creating a new law. And so they sat down with the government of Canada and they said, look, what we need is a law that will let us off the hook. And they got, this is only a few years ago, in fact, it was just 2 years ago, they got the government of Canada to introduce a new law which would give them a way of getting out of the criminal charges by paying a large fine. And then Trudeau's cabinet tried to influence the Attorney General of Canada to have those criminal charges dropped under this new law. And she refused to do so, and she was forced to resign. And she's now running as an independent.
And yet, in the decommissioning of Pilgrim here in Massachusetts in the United States, SNC-Lavalin has partnered with Holtec in order to do the decommissioning. How did they get around the international ban on bidding on contracts to become involved here in the United States?
That's a good point. The World Bank, of course, is not a world law enforcement agency, right? And we don't have any enforceable international law. So what the World Bank did was they banned SNC-Lavalin and its subsidiaries from bidding on any contracts that have any financing from the World Bank. So as long as there's no financing from the World Bank, they can get around that. If they were convicted of criminal charges in Canada, which they almost certainly would be as far as I can see, then they would also be banned for 10 years from bidding on any federal government contracts here in Canada. And that would impinge upon what they're planning to do at Chalk River and elsewhere. Chalk River being the name of the primary federal nuclear laboratories where they did production of plutonium for the American nuclear weapons program for about 20 years after the end of World War II. So this SNC-Lavalin prohibition and the criminal charges are not absolute because they cannot be enforced. But what's happening here is that SNC-Lavalin is partners with a couple of other companies which have also been charged with criminal corruption, Fluor Company and Jacobs Company. They have both been also guilty of corruption charges. In my point of view, what we're seeing here is these corporations are being attracted to the multi-billion dollar funds that were established by being deducted from the citizens as they paid for their electricity. These funds were built up for the purpose of paying for safe handling of the radioactive waste and safe decommissioning, which would guarantee that the public was not going to suffer the consequences of radioactive contamination due to careless handling. Now, these companies, they see those multi-billion dollar funds and they say, wow, we could go and collect a whole bunch of those. This is my interpretation. And so SNC-Lavalin has partnered with Holtec, not just in the case that you mentioned, but in many other cases around the United States. They are already buying up nuclear reactors, not now, but when they shut down, so that they will take ownership when they're shut down in order to tap into those multi-billion dollar decommissioning and waste management funds. And then, of course, in order to maximize profit, they will want to be able to do the job as cost effectively, i.e. cheaply as possible, and as time efficiently, that is quickly as possible. So the danger here is that the corporate profits are likely to take priority over the health and safety and environmental considerations that we thought should be foremost when we allowed nuclear power to get such a deep foothold in our society. We also have the situation that SNC-Lavalin stocks prices have been plummeting on the market because of the corruption scandals that have been occurring here in Canada. And as a result of that, SNC-Lavalin has told its investors that they are going to stop doing some of the things they were doing in the past that were not paying so much money, that were not causing so much profit. And they would concentrate on the things where they could maximize profit, especially the nuclear field. So it's quite clear, they've said it themselves, that their main goal in going into the nuclear decommissioning field is to make fast profits.
Gordon, this is a stunning overview and summary with great specificity of the situation, actually not only in Canada, but reaching far beyond. Is there anything that you feel you haven't gotten in at this point that you would like to add?
I think that we are really in a watershed here. The age of nuclear power, as I've said for the last several years, is really winding down. I don't think these small modular reactors are ultimately going to be successful. However, a lot more damage can be done by building a bunch of them. The economics shows that when you build a smaller reactor, it simply costs more per megawatt of electricity than a large reactor. The reason they built large reactors in the first place was what they call economies of scale. So when you build a small reactor, it's automatically going to be more costly and therefore less profitable. The only way the small reactors can be successful is if you mass produce them and sell at least several hundred, if not thousands of them. So unless you can sell hundreds or thousands of these small modular reactors, they are not going to break even. They're not going to pay for themselves. Now, that is already a big challenge. But on top of that, we have, believe it or not, 150 different designs of small modular reactors. We've got companies by the dozens that are jostling at each other's elbows and chafing at the neck to try and get their particular design to be the chosen one. Given that degree of competition, what are the chances that one design will corner the market and be able to sell the hundreds or thousands of units necessary to break even? I think it's very unlikely that this is going to happen. I think that what we're seeing here is another diversionary tactic, the kind of thing that Trump is very good at. President Trump, very often, he knows how to throw out some skyrockets of misdirection in order to get people off his back on things that he might have been found very uncomfortable. Well, the nuclear industry does the same thing. Rather than have the world turn against them for having created this curse of everlasting radioactive waste, which is in fact the case, they promise a nirvana, they promise a heaven around the corner. And the heaven around the corner was first announced in the year 2000 when they said they were going to have a nuclear renaissance. And remember the nuclear renaissance? They beat the drum and they had parades and celebrations. And, oh, the nuclear renaissance is coming. The nuclear renaissance is coming. There's going to be thousands of large nuclear reactors built all over the world. Well, we all know what happened to that. It failed miserably. It flopped. It was a huge flop. And in fact, it drove many companies into bankruptcy, including the French company Areva, which was bailed out by the French government, including Westinghouse in the United States. And in fact, this renaissance never took place. Well, what we're seeing now with the small modular reactors is a second kick at the can. Okay, the big renaissance didn't work. Let's try a small renaissance. And once again, they're making promises that cannot be kept. They cannot possibly keep these promises for the reasons which I mentioned. Moreover, people don't realize that as they build these small modular reactors, they're creating even more radioactive waste sites, which are probably never going to be decontaminated. We've already seen here in Canada that their preferred method for getting rid of these radioactive hulks is to simply grout them in place and not take them away, which means the whole American landscape and the whole world landscape, everywhere there's small modular reactors built, there'll be radioactive waste sites, every one of them. How do you look after all these radioactive waste sites? Well, they have no intention of looking after them. They just want to tiptoe away and say, hey, not our problem, it's your problem now. This is the difficulty that people have to wake up and they have to realize that we are being played for fools. Because we're being left with this legacy which has not been eliminated. You can't eliminate the nuclear waste legacy. Putting it underground doesn't even do it. I was in Sweden recently at an invitational conference which included the Swedish nuclear authorities as well as various people who are critical of nuclear energy. Myself, it was by invitation only, including myself and other people who are knowledgeable on the subject. And what we were talking about there, and this was led, by the way, the whole thing was planned and led by a PhD nuclear physicist from the United States. And the whole exercise was how do we communicate to people 2,000, 4,000, 10,000 years from now, how do we communicate to them the danger that we're leaving to them in the form of these high-level radioactive waste burial sites? I'm talking here about the underground high-level waste, let alone the above-ground low and intermediate level waste. And the answer was, we don't even know what language they're going to be speaking. We can't be sure that any of the languages that are in use today are going to be recognizable by these people. And if we tried to communicate through some kind of pictogram or something, warning that this is dangerous, do not dig here. Well, if you were an archaeologist in the future, you'd say, hey, let's dig here. And something really interesting, it says, don't dig. I mean, that's what we did with the pyramids, right? They have warnings saying curses. You're going to die if you enter here. Oh, wow. Let's go in.
Gordon, this has been a masterclass in nuclear truth. And while it's framed as coming from Canada, so much of it is applicable to anyone who is dealing with nuclear issues in their own country, state, province, whatever the demarcation happens to be. And I think one of the most important things people can do is get on your email list, because you send out phenomenal, really clear email with explanations of just about everything that's going on. If people wish to get your email and get the information on your website, where can they go and what do they need to do?
All right. Well, the website itself is ccnr.org. That's Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. We're a nonprofit organization, so that's the ORG. And my email is there on the page, ccnr@web.ca. And all anybody has to do is just drop me a line and say, please add me to your list, and I'll do so. I'd like to just say one final word, and that is that people have to realize that this legacy of radioactive waste is something that the industry wants to abandon. But we cannot abandon it, because we're on planet Earth, and planet Earth is round, not flat. We can't shove it off the edge of the world the way the nuclear industry would like to do. I joke that they are the last believers in the Flat Earth Society, because they think they can shove it off the edge of the world. You can't. The world is round, and therefore we, the citizens of Earth, have got to seize control of the plans as to how this waste is being transported, how it's being processed, how it's being managed. It doesn't mean that the industry shouldn't pay for it. They definitely should. And the industry expertise shouldn't be used, but they should not be the ones making the decisions.
From your mouth to somebody's ears, Gordon, thank you so much, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
Dr. Gordon Edwards, co-founder and president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. You can get on his email distribution list, and I strongly urge that you do, by going to ccnr.org and sending him an email from there. Activist shout-outs! Are you familiar with NukeMap? That's the program that allows you online to program in your location, the size of a nuclear bomb you would like to drop on it, and other variables, and then push a button to see exactly what the damage would be in terms of deaths, injuries, and other statistics of interest. Well, now NukeMap is coming up with a virtual reality experience that lets users detonate a nuclear weapon in New York City. The simulation is designed to educate the public about the scale and scope of atomic explosions, and it's part of a $500,000 project called Reinventing Civil Defense, which aims to restore a broad cultural understanding of nuclear risk. Right now, it's still under development, with New York City being the focus for it. But future iterations will allow users to nuke any location in the world, virtually, of course. Until the VR version becomes available, check with the classic NukeMap experience. It's at nuclearsecrecy.com/NukeMap. We will also link to it on the website. And gratitude to Alex Wellerstein for having come up with this idea and creating it in the first place. And it is with great sadness that we announce the passing of Francis Crowe, the peace activist, anti-nuclear activist who worked for the closure of Vermont Yankee. She was 100 years old. Francis was revered throughout the activist community in the Northeast. getting arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience at the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant in September of 2009, and also in January of 2014 when she was 94 years old. She is featured in two films by Robbie Lepser. Frances Turns 100 is a four-minute short film he made on her 100th birthday, which consisted of a march through the streets of Northampton, and the feature-length Power Struggle, which chronicles the successful grassroots citizens' effort to shut down the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. My favorite picture of Frances Crowe is this week's keystone picture for the episode, and you will find it at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 427. Here's today's final thought. Denial. No, it's not that river in Egypt. It's the default setting for anyone facing an issue with which they simply do not wish to engage. We hear about it in family systems, in 12-step programs. Anytime anyone sticks their fingers in their ears, shuts their eyes tight, and keeps saying, la, 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 rather than consider a difficult situation and determining what to do about it. I'll admit, nuclear information is tough to stomach. And the dang stuff makes it easy to ignore because radiation from nuclear materials is invisible, can't be detected by your eyes, nose, ears, tongue, or skin. And the nuclear industry revels in using complex terms to make it impossible to understand. So people tend to glaze over or change subject or just walk away when faced with even the most elementary nuclear information. That's denial. But nuclear radiation, tiny atomic particles flying invisibly in all directions from radioactive elements, doesn't care if you pay attention to it or not. Radiation will do what it will do. Invisibly take down our health, damage our genetics so we can't reproduce completely healthy children, erode the very fabric of life on the planet. Once you learn something about radiation, you have in front of you three possible reactions: fight, flight, or freeze. Same as in any crisis situation. Let's pick this one apart. Flight? Not possible. In the words of Bonnie Raitt's post Three Mile Island song, ain't nowhere you can run. As you heard from Gordon Edwards earlier in this episode, radiation is everywhere. Remember what he said about background radiation? And we humans have done it to ourselves. There is no planet B. You're here, and so is radiation, and there is no away possible. So flight is off the table, which leads to freeze. You don't know what to do, so you do nothing with great energy. To those of you who may be frozen and still you've listened to this show this long, I have a suggestion. Breathe. That's right. Now another breath. Good. And another. Realize that you are not alone. This stuff is truly frightening, and that there's a world of ordinary people who are already working to do whatever can be done to stop the situation from getting worse before it can possibly get better. Which leads us to fight. That's what you're doing by listening to Nuclear Hot Seat. Fighting against the nuclear ignorance or fear or overwhelm that the industry counts on to keep us in place, so they can keep contaminating the earth in the name of corporate greed. You are fighting the good fight when you don't allow denial to switch off your brain when nuclear matters come up. There are regular people out there who have learned to recognize the nuclear lies, push back with a greater truth, and join both a local and an international community of really terrific people who have also been pushing back against the depth and danger of this industry's betrayal of our planetary trust. You can fight when you stay conscious. And, in the process, should you hit overwhelm, as we all do, you take that breath and another. Maybe visit a special place in nature, or go eat some ice cream, and hug your kids or grandkids. Then you take more breaths. Stay open to information, and when you can, take your next action. We need every one of you to be aware of what the nuclear industry has been doing to us for close to 80 years. You see, ignorance will change nothing. Fighting back feels better. So I invite you to step across that Egyptian river, denial, and join the ever-growing movement of people who stand together, tall and proud and vocal and ever more powerful, in opposing nuclear around the world in all its Hydra-headed menace. Trust me, fighting back is the best antidepressant you will ever find. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 27, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, miningawareness.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, Reuters.com, HindustanTimes.com, Mirror.co.uk, AlJazeera.com, TheMoscowTimes.com, DW.com, TheConversation.com, LEP.co.uk, Reuters, en.rfi.fr, well, it's South African, businessinsider.com, theguardian.com, wtvbam.com, hani.co.kr, nhk.or.jp, sciencealert.com, denver.cbslocal.com, counterpunch.org, lasvegassun.com, thespectrum.com, The New York Times, thedailybeast.com, smh.com.au, the BBC, and, as always, the slow-motion murderers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Holtec International. Nuclear Hot Seat is now available on all of your favorite podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play. However you prefer to listen to your podcast, you will find us there. And we've got tabs to connect you at the top of our website landing page, nuclearhotseat.com. And if there's a favorite platform we've missed, let us know, and we will load it up there as soon as possible. And if you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, the split instant that it posts, it's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow opt-in box, and sign up for one email a week that will give you a link to the latest show and a small description of what's in it. Now, speaking of those stories, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to support us with a donation of any size at nuclearhotseat.com. We will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby, Halevi, and Hartestree Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestree Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only can what you don't know hurt you, chances are that it probably already has. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.
Hey, this is JJ Inc., and when I'm on planet Earth, I listen to UCY.TV.